I'm going to start by talking a little bit about this. This is a revisit of a theme that we were looking at 11 years ago. And so I want to start by talking a little bit about some of the things that I think came out of that previous conference, and then what I think I've learned over the last 11 years since that conference actually occurred. And I'll start with, we have a number of people on today, just like yesterday, that spoke at the last conference. And Alan Blinder, who's on the policy panel today, was also on the policy panel 11 years ago. And when he began his discussion, he started with an interesting observation that he thought it was curious that the Federal Reserve had decided to have this conference rather than the Bank of Japan or somebody in Europe, given what the economic circumstances was. Now, in part, I might highlight that that would indicate some great forecasting prowess by our research director, Jeff Tuttle, and research director, Jeff Fuhrer, and our deputy director, Jeff Tuttle, who were active both last time and this time in putting the conference together, and Giovanni's been very active in putting this conference together as well. A couple people noted at the beginning of the cocktail hour that we had particularly good timing for this conference, and I would say that it was good timing, but we really did believe the extended period language, and so it probably was somewhat observable that we could have a conference that was going to focus on how do we deal with a low inflation environment and low interest rates even a year ago. It was very different circumstances that we had the last conference. The unemployment rate was well below 5%. The inflation rate was very close to 2%. And we were in the midst of what a number of people talked about yesterday as the great moderation. There was growing confidence, I think, that volatility and severe business cycles had been tamed. And as a result, it was interesting that we were having a conference given how many economists thought we were in a fairly benign environment. The one caution was what was happening in Japan at the time that we were having that conference. And Kazuo Ueda, who is on the policy panel today, was also on the policy panel 11 years ago. And he made the comment that it will be more painful than you can possibly imagine if you hit the zero bound. And unfortunately, I think we now really, really believe that message from 11 years ago. I would note that at that time, many people thought Japan was primarily an anomaly, that it may not be that apropos to the United States or Europe, and I think that we found actually that it's much more apropos than any of us would have thought 11 years ago. And I would also note that most of the participants thought that Japan really was on the mend, that the problems they were facing they had well in train, and that they were going to be resolving them. So we thought that while it was interesting that Japan had the problems that they had, most of the participants seemed to think it was a fairly low probability event that we would see it elsewhere in the world. There was some disagreement about how effective alternative policies were going to be, but I think most of the participants at that conference highlighted that there certainly was no reason not to try. This highlights how different this conference is, what the environment is, relative to where we were before. So what this shows is the percent change from peak employment. The dark black line is the period that reflects the period that we've currently experienced. It just highlights that it's a dramatically different situation than we've seen in most of the post-war period. There is a reason why this is being called the Great Recession. It had dramatic impacts. The impact on employment has been particularly severe. And so when we're thinking about the various graphs, charts, and regressions over the course of these 2 days, it really is important to highlight how significant an impact this has had both in the United States, but I would also say globally. So this is a really important issue. This is more than an academic issue. This is something that everybody in the room should be deeply concerned about. We have some of the best economic minds in the country in this room, and I think this really is an issue that we need to be really focused on in terms of how do we make sure we don't ever get into this situation again. I think another thing that has been highlighted over the last 3 years is how important financial markets and financial institutions are. at our conference in 1999, I think most of the focus was, in a very low inflation environment with interest rates very low, what would be the impact on the banking industry and bank balance sheets? There was less of a focus on how the banking industry and bank balance sheets would affect the real economy. And I think that has come in to a much more attention over the course of the disturbance that we've had over the last 3 years. So I think that it is very important to think about how financial market developments can be incorporated into our economic models. When there aren't big financial disruptions, you don't see a lot of it in the historical data, there may not be a clarion call to put it in your models. But I think now there is a clarion call to put it in our models and think about how some of the spillover effects that we've actually observed can be integrated. I would say even in the Federal Reserve, I mean, I think David would highlight that we've had to struggle with thinking about how financial markets could more effectively be placed in the modeling context. I think that's true for all the modelers that are in this room, but I think it is a challenge for many dissertations to come to really understand how we can model this much better than we did going into this crisis. So just to summarize the differences between the last conference and this conference, at least in terms of the economic circumstances, instead of the Great Moderation, we are coming out of the Great Recession. Japan still fighting deflation more than a decade later. Japan, the United States, and the euro area have all dropped their interest rates dramatically, something that people thought was very unlikely to occur. The United States has experienced high unemployment rates and inflation well below 2% and lingering financial headwinds. So this isn't an academic discussion. It really is an important policy discussion. And I think that's exactly why we're having this conference that's revisiting those issues that we raised at that time. So let me just start talking a little bit about Japan. I've mentioned to a couple people that it really is curious that an economy that until recently was the second largest economy in the world could go through the kinds of problems that they had without more research being done into the circumstances of the problems and the ways they tried to resolve it. What this chart shows is, I think as everybody knows, at the start of the decade in the 1990s, the Japanese experienced a very substantial decline in both their stock price but also real estate prices. Their inflation story, though, actually was much more benign. They had very low inflation rates through the first half of the decade, but it was only when they took some confidence that they were going to be recovering and they tightened both fiscal and monetary policy that they took what was a low inflation environment into what was a deflationary environment. And you can see at the time of our conference, that 1999, that they were just starting to fight the deflation problem. But as you look to the right, it got far from resolved. And if you look at the far right, certainly the financial crisis of the last 3 years has exacerbated a problem that they have already been fighting for over a decade. So core inflation was initially low and positive, but austerity measures taken by monetary and fiscal policies, I think, had the impact of contributing to the problems lingering on. They had significant problems in their financial sector, something that I think we're also seeing in both the United States and Europe. Monetary policy making, I think we have seen, is particularly challenging because problems with the zero bound are more than likely going to occur in the midst of a financial crisis as well. I don't think it's a coincidence that the Japanese experienced a financial crisis and hit the zero bound. We've had a financial crisis and hit the zero bound, and arguably Europe is in a similar situation as well. I think also it highlights that deflation is particularly pernicious once it sets in. It's difficult to counteract, and so you want to try to avoid it getting firmly established. It's not that the Japanese government hasn't tried to do a lot over the past 11 years. So you can see the debt to GDP actually has gone up. Now, you might argue that it's gone up too gradually, but it's gone up quite dramatically over time. So they have taken fiscal measures to try to address the problem. They also dramatically expanded their balance sheet. So it's not that the monetary authorities completely ignore the problem. They actually were expanding their balance sheet very significantly, though again, you might argue that they were doing it a little more gradually than you might otherwise choose. So what do I take from the implications of the Japanese experience? First, I think there is good news that there's no evidence of a deflation spiral. If you read back at our volume from 11 years ago, deflation spirals were one of the main focuses of many of the theoretical pieces. And I think it is good news that we haven't seen something like that actually occur. I think in part that is the reflection of the fact that they were doing fiscal and monetary policies that were fairly unconventional by historical standards. The bad news is that despite them taking fairly substantial fiscal and monetary measures, the deflation has been very difficult to overcome. So the policy implication, prevention may be more important than the cure, because the cure looks like it's very difficult to obtain, and it highlights that you might want to take some insurance out against making sure that a tail event of this sort doesn't actually occur. I think it also highlights that if you have a financially fragile economy, that you have to be particularly careful how quickly you remove fiscal or monetary policies, that if you too quickly go into austerity mode, you can certainly complicate the problems for decision makers. I next want to turn to a second issue that got some attention at our earlier conference, but because there hadn't been any large-scale asset purchase programs in the United States, it was kind of one of many things that were listed in many of the papers that occurred in that earlier conference. Obviously, we have a little bit more experience now with this, and I think it is very important that we get empirical work that tries to capture exactly how important these programs are. I would highlight a couple things. One is that the unconventional policies we've had to take are still relatively new. We haven't taken very many, at least if you're looking at it as at particular time frame. And it's very difficult to isolate the effects. So yesterday we did have some discussion of the LSAP program. There was some disagreement about how effective it is. It's not surprising that empirically it can be a little bit difficult to isolate, because we're doing these unconventional policies because of economic outcomes that we certainly didn't want to see. And it's not just monetary policy that's changing. We're changing regulatory policy. Many of our trading partners are changing their policies as well. So kind of isolating in the midst of a crisis the impact of just this program can be challenging. Second, I would highlight that a variety of economic and financial variables are well outside the normal ranges. And so when you're well outside the normal ranges, it makes it more difficult to use traditional models to be able to figure out what the impact is. And finally, to the extent that policies are anticipated, it's going to be very difficult to isolate the effect of a particular policy change, because it has been telegraphed well in advance. Then you're not going to see much of an impact on the announcement date, because it will already be fully embedded in the market. So let me just briefly go through each of the channels and talk about them. So the first effect that you'd expect is that the large-scale asset purchase program would reduce the long-term rates if you're buying a long-term asset. So the large-scale asset purchase program that we did do was primarily focused on the mortgage-backed securities market. And this just shows you a chart when we first announced what we were going to do. And you can see that the mortgage rates were trading prior to the announcement roughly around 6%. Obviously, lots of things affect mortgage rates. But they were bouncing around 6%. After the announcement, they continued to bounce around, but they were bouncing around at 5%. Now, this isn't a fully fleshed-out study. There are plenty of people in this audience who've done that. But I think visually, it certainly looks like there was a significant difference between what was happening prior to the announcement of that program and what was happening afterwards. And so the various estimates that a number of people in this room have done has been between 25 and 100 basis points. That seems credible when I look at a picture that visually I can see there looks like a relatively significant effect. Now, it's not just the mortgage instruments that we're hoping to affect. We're really trying to affect a wide variety of long-term securities. So you care about what the cross-correlation of assets is. Ideally, you want to affect corporate bonds. If you're buying 10-year treasuries, you'd also want to be affecting the mortgage rate. So I think a number of studies have started to look at these cross-correlations. Again, this is just a visual inspection, but I think there are other people in the room who've done some more careful empirical analysis. And I do think with the announcement we have seen that there does seem to be correlation across the assets, that both corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, and treasury securities tend to react when we do purchase any one of the securities we've chosen to purchase. So the biggest effect is going to be on the own rate, but the cross rates are going to be important, and I think the empirical studies that have been done to date verify that. The third thing that it does is it highlights that we are changing policy, and so if someone was to expect that short-term rates at some point in the near future were going to go up, obviously, if you're doing a large-scale asset purchase program, it may push out the time that you think that we'll have a reversal and that rates will actually rise. So it's not just the long end of the market that gets affected. The short end of the market also gets affected. So if you look at one-year, two-year, and three-year treasury rates, you would expect to see an impact if people really started to believe that extended period of time may be extended further than they actually thought previously. And so you can see that the three-year treasury rate prior to the announcement had tended to be well above 2%. After that announcement, it's been below 2%, and more recently, it's been trending down. Now, it's not just the short-term treasury rates that affect this. Obviously, it affects short- and medium-term rates that are done by corporations and other types of organizations. So it affects the cost of finance not only at the long end of the market, but also at the short and medium terms. The exchange rate channel, which has gotten a little bit more attention recently, anytime that you change interest rates in the United States but don't change them in other places, you would expect that there would be some impact on exchange rates. It might not be what your primary focus was, but I think there needs to be more work understanding the international channel. This doesn't come out nearly as apparently in visual inspection because a lot more is going on when we make these announcements. So you care about what's happening with trading partners, not only what's happening in the United States. And there are a lot of other things that are occurring at the same time. So I think in particular, over the crisis period, people are holding U.S. dollars in part because they want a precautionary demand for dollars. And so if you have a strong precautionary demand for dollars, then that's going to be at times confounding whatever else we're doing at the time, particularly if in part we're reacting to some of the financial problems that are occurring. So while a visual inspection because of some of these other factors isn't nearly as clear, I think it's something that did get highlighted in a number of the papers. Bennett McCollum's paper 10, 11 years ago highlighted the international transmission mechanism, and I think it is something worth studying more. And the final channel that I would focus on is the lending channel. So a number of large corporations have issued very substantial amounts of corporate debt. When somebody issues a very large corporate issuance, it means that they don't have to be reliant either on direct loans from banks or lines of credit from banks. That frees up bank balance sheets so that they can now focus on more bank-dependent borrowers. It hasn't been an area that's gotten much focus, but I think it would be interesting to better understand whether there are lending channels here that may be important. So just some concluding observations. Relative to 11 years ago, I think one thing we've learned is that it's clearly much more difficult to operate when we have the zero-bound binding. I think that the experience in Japan has highlighted that a gradual response to the kinds of problems that may occur may not be the response that we want to do. It may be necessary to take more aggressive policies, and that we certainly want to take policies to prevent deflation from occurring before it actually occurs. It is particularly difficult to address once it already has gotten deeply embedded in the economy. I think that there are a number of ways that the Federal Reserve can react to hitting the zero bound. I focused on the LSAP program. There are other programs that I think the Jackson Hole speech by the chairman highlighted some of the other alternatives. But I think the LSAP program is something that can be effective at making a difference. And I think the role of banking and financial markets was a major contributor and is something that I hope all the researchers in the room actually take quite seriously to get a better understanding of some of the financial market challenges. And one thing that I think economists are not particularly good at is figuring out the political economy of these kinds of situations. I think the Japanese experience has highlighted that both fiscal and monetary policymakers can find it quite challenging in an environment where you hit the zero bound. I think both ourselves and the Europeans are finding out the same thing. And so even if you think you know what the right policies are, making sure that you're able to get a consensus among policymakers, I think has turned out to be extremely challenging, and I think will continue to be so. So those are just some comments to start off the second day, and we're going to move right into the next section. So if the panelists could please come up, and we'll begin the next session straight away. Thank you.